Barefoot Blues Hour is made possible in part by the Belfast Framer and Gallery, featuring custom framing, prints, posters, and monthly exhibits of original art. Open weekdays 10 to 5 or by appointment at 96 Main Street in Belfast.
Information presented in the following program represents the opinions of the participants and does not constitute medical advice. Please consult your physician before undertaking any treatment or therapy.
Health-related programming on WERU is made possible in part by Inner Tapestry, Maine's holistic journal. Featuring alternative health and natural living articles, calendar listings, and a directory of resources. Available at health food stores and alternative health centers, 781-9885 or innertapestry.org. And by the nonprofit Whole Health Center on Mount Desert Island. Since 1981, providing a broad spectrum of integrated care, including individual and couples counseling, as well as nutritional and herbal health care, body work, and traditional Qigong therapies. 288-4128 or thewholehealthcenter.com.
And the time is 10:02, and you are tuned to your community radio station, WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, 102.9 Bangor, and streaming online at weru.org. Common Health with Jim Fisher is next.
Calling all listeners, we need you to join our dialogue on health in Maine. This is Jim Fisher of the Hancock County Planning Commission and host of Common Health. Today we're discussing the effect of diet on personal and public health. The data are clear. We eat more fast, prepackaged junk foods and are putting on weight at a record pace. What are the health consequences of the new American diet? Who profits from our bad taste? How can we turn the tide on Maine's infatuation? Our personal health relies upon our public health. Your job is to call in and join our dialogue to make Maine a healthier place to live. Call us anytime at 469-0500 or toll free at 866-625-9378. And this is Pledge Week, so I'll be giving out another phone number. If you would please call in to make a pledge, you'll want to call 1-800-643-6273 to help support programs like Common Health, Barefoot Blues, Morning in Maine, and all the other great programming on WERU. I'm joined this morning by two guests. This is part two of our swimsuit edition for the summer. Part one, we talked about physical activity and fitness, and today we're talking about diet, but we're not talking about diet in the traditional or the American sense of counting carbohydrates or calories. We're talking about eating well. And joining us today are Bob St. Peter of the Independent Food Project and Stuart at the Good Life Center. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Jim.
And on the line, we have Elliot Coleman, the owner of Four Seasons Farm. Good morning, Elliot.
Good morning.
Well, it's great to have you here. I understand Elliot's going to be with us for about 30 minutes, so I'm going to let Bob cool his heels for a while. He'll chime in occasionally, but I want to get the most out of Elliot that I can. We're very grateful that you're able to take time off your busy schedule. I know you're a full-time farmer, but why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be involved in growing healthy food?
Well, it's very simple. I like to eat well. And if you like to eat well and have taste buds, you soon realize that the best food comes from home gardens and local farms. And that's why very often in the summer, the home gardeners are the ones who are probably eating better than anybody, and second to them are the people who can purchase their food directly from local farms. When you focus on growing food for flavor, and human beings are pretty good at hitting what they focus on, then you get the best of all worlds.
And it's no easy thing to become a farmer in Maine. I don't think you inherited your farm, so how'd you get started?
Oh, I got inspired to get into small farming by reading Helen Scott Nearing's Living the Good Life, and I came over to visit them the following year, and we got along famously, and when I got back to New Hampshire, where I was living then, there was a postcard from Helen saying, what the heck, why didn't we buy the back half of their farm? They weren't using it, so we did. And the thing that made it all possible was they sold it to us for what they'd paid for it 20 years before.
Wow. And I guess now how much land are you farming?
We have vegetables on exactly an acre and a half. A quarter acre of that is covered with greenhouses. And then we have an additional 10 to 12 acres cleared that are in pastures that we're going to get back into livestock next year. And The rest of the 40 acres that we own, we decided when we came here that two-thirds of it should belong to Mother Nature, so the deer and the antelope had a place to play, and that's what we've done.
That's amazing. So you're able to run a commercial operation on just a few acres of land.
The production from a few acres intensively cultivated is pretty impressive. Last year, off an acre and a half, we sold $110,000 worth of produce to the local market.
That's great. And it's fairly intensive, then. You have things packed in there pretty tightly.
We double crop partly everything, and of course in the greenhouse there's five or six crops a year, but outdoors we double crop almost everything and occasionally triple crop. And so there are rotations within rotations to try and take advantage of all the wonderful little things that Mother Nature does for you for free. Some crops benefit the crop that follows them because of what they do or don't take out of the soil, and other crops benefit the following year, and some crops like to be fertilized with seaweed and grow right where you turn it under, and other crops prefer to grow the year after you turn under seaweed. So there's fertilizer rotations, yearly crop rotations, and in-year crop rotations.
Wow. And you do other things to promote healthy foods and farming. I understand you've written a number of books. Can you tell me a little bit about those?
Well, my first book was The New Organic Grower, and I wrote that mainly because when I started back in the late 60s, there were really no models to follow, and I spent a lot of time phoning people, writing people, and actually traveling. I was fortunate to get to Europe a number of times and visit small farmers there. And there was all this wonderful hints that people had given me, all this wonderful information, and I sort of wanted to spread it around in order to thank them for their contributions to my farming system and see if we couldn't get other people using it and refining it even further.
And part of any successful farm, I think, is having a successful partner. And I understand Barbara, your wife, has also written and lectured on issues about food and health.
We have a wonderful partnership together. She is also one of the best cooks I know, so she's responsible for demonstrating how the fantastic products of the farm can become even more fantastic after they have been through the hands of a really genius food preparer.
We're talking about slow food here.
Definitely. And what's really fascinating when you think about it is that all the great cuisines originally began with the products of the region where they exist. And those products originally were the products of the peasant farmers. So none of the great cuisines are anything exotic or expensive. They're just based on using the best local foods and using them imaginatively.
I couldn't agree more. I want to remind callers, this is a call, or listeners rather, this is a call-in show, and it only works if you call in. If you have questions for Elliot and Bob, who we'll be talking to a lot more in the second half hour, you can call us locally at 469-0500 or call us toll-free at 866-625-9378. And don't forget, if you can call in a pledge for WERU, you'll want to call 1-800-643-6273. Well, Elliot, now I'll ask Bob to chime in on this too. What do you think is good food?
Well, the sign out at the end of our driveway next to the sign that advertises our farm stand says real farming, real food. And to me, real food, first off, is fresh. So under the real food banner, I don't include any processed foods except the traditional ones like wine or beer or sauerkraut. Certainly not the stuff that is designed to sit forever on the shelves of a supermarket. I'm often just fascinated how the food purveyors have managed to convince people that something like ultra-pasteurized milk is a good product, because the question consumers should always ask themselves is, who's benefiting from this product? And the person who's benefiting from ultra-pasteurized milk are the guys who can now ship it all over the country. They didn't used to be able to do that with fresh milk, which is why dairies were always local, because this stuff can sit on the shelves for 60 days. Well, in order to do that, you have to make it so sterile and so lacking in nutrition for the organisms that would otherwise begin to decompose it, that I wonder why people actually think that that's beneficial for them to consume. And there's been that same sort of propaganda from the food companies for every one of their processed foods, which are definitely not real food. What do you think, Bob?
Elliot, I agree with you about the how food has gone from something that is, you know, healthful and tasteful and nourishing to this commodity to be bought and sold by companies who make hundreds of millions of dollars off of the processing and the marketing and the selling of food that comes from all over the world. I would add to your definition, Elliot, of good food as food that is not only regional but also cultural. And I find that I'm nourished in the traditions of the Northeast and of Maine in the foods that our forefathers and foremothers ate before us, who made use of the land and made use of what was available, because I find that, you know, nourishment comes from also, you know, the nutrients we take in, but also, you know, the culture of food and you know, how we share meals and all that as well, which is.
I think we have a caller on the line. Are you there? We have a lot of blinking lights, but it's a fundraiser. Are you on the line, caller?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Great. What is your question or comment?
This is a question for Elliot Coleman. You just mentioned crop rotations that complement the crop that comes later, and also the fertilization rotations with seaweed and other natural fertilizers that some crops do better that season and some the next. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that. Tell us which crops you were talking about.
The caller's been cut off, I think. Elliot, are you there to answer? We have a system. Elliot, are you there? No, Elliot's been cut off. Well, I'd comment briefly. I actually was an agriculture extensionist myself at one time in the Peace Corps, and one of the things we tried to do with crop rotation was to control insects. So if you had a particular insect that affected a crop, you wouldn't want to follow with that crop again, but you'd take something that the insects couldn't tolerate. It would more or less drive them out of the area. Sometimes multiple cropping, even putting something as attractive as marigolds around your plants, can help drive off some insects. Then there, all the legumes are nitrogen fixing. If the soil's healthy enough to begin with, planting legumes will actually build up the nitrogen content in your soil that other crops can take advantage of. But Bob, you probably know a lot more about this than me.
Well, yeah, the idea is to, you know, is to follow crops with crops that aren't going to deplete the nutrients that the previous crop were using that complement the soil, as you said, Jim. But also give back to the soil. And the case of legumes is an excellent example, because they have this fantastic ability to fix nitrogen from the air and add it to the soil. So if you're, you know, if you're following a, you know, heavy feeder like corn, for example, with a legume, peas or beans, then the nitrogen that the corn is using in its growth is being replenished not by chemical fertilizers, but by something that you can either turn under and add organic matter to your soil, or something that you can actually eat.
And I should explain to listeners, the light has not stopped blinking for the last 5 minutes. And I think that in the pledge drive, a wrong button was hit maybe. And Elliot, I believe, has been disconnected, but we're trying to call him back to get more of his ideas. But we do appreciate your calls. And if other calls come in, Bob and I are certainly ready to talk to you about it. We had a tremendous problem in Ecuador, where I was doing agriculture, with nematodes and soil-borne insects. And there were some crops that once they got established, that was it. You could never grow that crop again. The chemical alternative was to saturate the soil with a toxic nematicides, they were called, kind of an insecticide. And I think that it's sort of over at that point. If you've made a mistake, and that's something that was happening all over South America, and the only solution seemed to be either to drop the crop or to go into some really terrible chemicals. And the chemical corporations were right there to sell them if you wanted them. But I don't know in Brooksville if there are issues like that where soils have been lost to certain plagues or insects.
I don't know. Yeah, we have our the potato beetles and cucumber beetles and all that. But I know that Elliot doesn't use anything on his farm, and when I walk through, and any chemical fertilizers or chemical pesticides or herbicides, and when I walk through his farm, it's, I don't know if immaculate is the right term, but it's pretty close, and they're on bugs. You know, he has these vibrant, healthy looking crops that all stem from the health of the soil.
Good line, Bob. I'm back.
Welcome back.
Yeah.
I'm sorry you were cut off.
Well, I think the food processors probably weren't happy with what I said, and they had their agents.
I think it was Monsanto.
Yeah. There are a couple of books that I'd love to recommend to people who are listening, if they're also readers, that I think cover a whole lot of good ideas about food and where we should be going with it. And one of them is entitled, So Shall We Reap. And the author's name is Colin Tudge. And the book is almost summed up in a line in the first paragraph of its introduction, which I will read because I think it's so well put. Health, environment, good relations between nations, everything follows or can follow from good farming. And the book is devoted to explaining what good enlightened agriculture is about and how the world can be far better fed because of it. And the second book is called The Centrality of Agriculture by another Colin, this time Colin Duncan. And it is just a marvelous argument about how important it is to put agriculture back where it was when we first got out of the caves. I mean, this was the activity that allowed the human societies to flourish, and we have unfortunately discounted it to our peril.
Well, I'd like to follow up on that. First, I want to remind listeners, despite all the chaos here, that we still do want you to call in. If you have a pledge to call in to WERU, you can call 1-800-643-6273. We're really pushing hard to raise $60,000 in this pledge drive, and we need your help. You can also call in your questions or comments for Common Health locally at 469-0500 or toll-free at 866-625-9378, and we have a caller on the line. Please offer your question or comment.
Hi, guys. This is Jenny. I'm the produce manager at the Blue Hill Co-op.
Oh, good for you.
Hi, Elliot. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
I just wanted to pose a question, I guess, and also kind of comment. As a produce manager here in Blue Hill, I oftentimes feel that our produce, no matter how great it is oftentimes too expensive to be considered accessible to a lot of people in the area. And I was wondering how you guys thought about how we can make organic and local food not just more accessible, but also make it appear as though it's an investment that, because it stays in the community, is more valuable to a community. I feel like oftentimes organic and local and it has so much of a stigma attached to it. Does that make sense?
Oh, it's a great question, Jen. The reason I opened my remarks at the start of the show talking about how home gardeners eat well is because I encourage anybody who wants to eat well to have a home garden. And when you think about the fact that the very best fertilizer, the fertilizer that allows us and other organic farmers to achieve the results we achieve, the very best fertilizer is compost,
mm-hmm.
and compost is made for free in your backyard from waste products, I would say that sort of activity definitely puts local and organic food easily available to everybody if they're willing to have a home garden. And if they're not, boy, at that point, then I really object to putting the onus of feeding the world affordably on the farmer, because if you look at the incomes around the country, you will find that there are hardly any farmers that are able to support themselves on the income from farming. Practically every Midwestern farmer has a spouse with a teaching job or something, just so they can continue to farm. So what we have created in our civilization is a situation where food has been cheapened, so people can then go out and buy two cars and two VCRs. And whether it's the government's responsibility to solve that, probably is, but I think farmers are doing everything they can.
And the government spends billions of dollars subsidizing certain crops and certain commodities. So there are billions of dollars that the government's paying to farmers to produce crops that we already have too much of. Corn is an excellent example. The USDA spends $5 billion a year producing corn. And we have so much corn that we've had to come up with all these ways of getting it into our food system.
Or our gas tanks.
Or our gas tanks, right. So in terms of access and getting increasing the access of high quality, preferably local food to low-income people, there's this pool of money, I think, that can be accessed. And if instead of subsidizing ethanol and inputs for Coca-Cola and PepsiCo, the form of high fructose corn syrup, then we ought to be looking at how we can subsidize or how we can get money into the pockets of people whose income doesn't allow them to go to the Blue Hill Co-op and purchase all of their food from local producers or natural foods suppliers, and getting enabling them to support their local agriculture, which is the healthiest food, and then you get into the issues of connecting low income people with obesity and with other food related illnesses and diseases. So if we direct money into the people who can best make access of it, then we can get away from having this disparity in price.
The other thing to think about too, Jen, is walk around the co-op, walk around the aisles, and in your mind put two meals together of very similar ingredients, but one meal is made with the raw materials prepared from scratch in the kitchen, and the other meal is using the processed foods, and you will find that the savings probably amount to a saving of 66%.
And also buying food at a retail store, you've got all these you have all these markups that are necessary in order to run a business, including the Blue Hill Co-op. And if there was more ability to access markets directly from farmer to consumer, then you can cut that out and you can get the prices down. It's not going to compete with agribusiness subsidies, but it's going to get the price down a little bit more. And also, I think there's this disconnect that we have with our food. We don't think twice about spending $20 to go out and see a movie and get some fast food, but we'll think twice about spending $3 for a pound of broccoli or something like that. So we have this attitude that food should be cheap and it ought to be cheap, and that enables markets to keep this price disparity.
I'll chime in. One thing that economists look at are what are called internal and external economies. And with food production, it's a great example where there's a certain amount, an organic grower, almost everything they do gets passed along in the price of the food. Whereas somebody who's growing things in a way that's not sustainable, using a lot of chemicals and spray, a lot of those costs aren't really borne directly by the farmer and don't get passed along in the food prices, at least not immediately. They're borne by people who are downstream of those chemicals who end up with contaminated wells, who end up with damage to their crops, to their yards, and to their health. And those costs are external. And it to the extent that, as a policy, as a national policy, we can see that everybody really pays the full price for their choices, we'd probably see organic produce being much more competitive than it is now in price. And in relation to that, we have a call, but let me put in a plug that I understand there's actually a protest or a meeting in the Blue Hill Town Park as we speak talking about spraying blueberries, which is a case, again, where there are these external effects of the choices that farmers have made in order to increase their production. We have a caller on the line. Nope. Oh, I'm afraid I don't. I sang goodbye to the other caller, I guess, and thank you for your call.
And since you bring up externalized cost, there are the environmental costs, water pollution and soil degradation, and those issues. But then there's also public health issues. You know, their obesity is an externalized cost of a cheap food system. Illnesses related to, you know, chemical pesticide exposure and the like. So, you know, access to good food is really a public health issue. And I think we ought to start looking at how the healthcare system can start supporting access to high quality, nutritious food.
And Elliot, are you still there?
Oh yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, I'm sorry, because I'm getting signals from the control room I don't understand, a lack of experience. I did want to talk a little more about environment and land use. I'm a planner, and I'm curious how you think agriculture in Maine is affected by land use policy, by suburbanization and exurbanization.
Well, I don't know if it's affected any differently here than it is elsewhere. The homeowner, the vacation home builder can pay so much more for land than a farmer can that in many cases the farmers are just priced out of the land market, you know, except for all the wonderful work that the Blue Hill Land Trust has been doing to give young growers access to that great soil along 199. For the most part, I think that's the biggest difficulty. And, you know, I joke about the fact that I would really like to be able to go up to a young college graduate, like in the movie of that same name, and put my arm around their shoulder and tell them I only have two words to say to them, market gardening, and actually mean that they can make as decent a living at that as they can at other things. And you can make a, you know, sort of a wonderful life. The living is harder. You got to really work at it to get a decent return for your hours. It's such a satisfying way of life that a lot of people do it. But we're working with a number of engineers on a very informal basis, trying to come up with a bunch of tools that will allow growers to be much more efficient and therefore make a better living in the process. And it's been slow, but we're making progress on that, and it's just one of the avenues that can be taken to try and get better and more reasonably priced food available to everybody.
I'm going to cut in here. I've been told how the phones work now, and we do have not one but two callers on the line. So let's take the first caller for your quick question or comment. Hello.
Hello.
You're on.
Hi, Jim. This is Marlena. I am told that I needed to call you to talk about the only real, true, healthy, organic local food, which is breastfeeding, breast milk. I know what you were talking about, you know, all these things of, you know, keeping the food, you know, cheap, and the society is going towards that. Yeah, we're spending $8 billion a year, the formula companies are making on this, where, you know, breast milk is free. I mean, how much better can you get and cheap than that? And then we have this little health crisis that, you know, less than a quarter of women are breastfeeding today. And I think that's just ridiculous considering all of the benefits that both to baby and the mother and community that it goes along with that.
So what organization are you with that's promoting breastfeeding?
I'm a member of La Leche League International, but I'm not actually calling for them. I'm just a member.
But it's a good resource for women who are pregnant and thinking about whether they want to breastfeed or use formulas.
Yeah, they support doing what you need to do. They're not lactivists, as some people say. I mean, some people within the group are, but, you know, the focus is on education of, you know, if you need to supplement with formula, you know, that's okay if that's what you need to do, because any breast milk's better than none.
I couldn't agree more. I'm going to have to thank you for the call and let the next caller in. They're stacking up. Okay. Thank you very much. Come in, caller. Are you there?
Hello.
Good morning.
Hi. I was wondering, I just read Michael Pollan's book about industrial agriculture. It was The Omnivore's Dilemma. And a couple interesting things in there. It basically sounds like the yield on corn went up from 25 bushels to per acre to 250, and they end up with all this extra stuff, mostly because of nitrogen, the Haber-Bosch process where they pull nitrogen out of the air and make fertilizer. And I was wondering what is going to happen you know, as we get to the peak of oil and gas production, what's going to happen to our agriculture? Is it going to kind of crash? And should if people's thoughts on what we could do to sort of get something going, like what Elliot Coleman's doing, but on a much, much larger scale, so that we can actually feed at least the people of Maine.
Well, there are plenty of large-scale organic farmers out in the Midwest, and ever since the early 70s, when Washington University in St. Louis did a study comparing the performance of 1,000-acre organic farmers with 1,000-acre chemical farmers, it was basically a wash. They were both producing the same yields. The benefit was that the organic farmers were spending less for their inputs. And
wow.
Ever since then, there have been study after study. The difficulty is that the organic farmers are not, for the most part, buying any inputs. They're using all the free resources of the natural world to create soil fertility and grow crops. And therefore, there is absolutely no reason for anyone to start a business trying to convince people to farm organically, because there's very little to sell them. And there's an enormous amount to sell to people who have been convinced that inputs are the answer to everything. And that's, therefore, the propaganda from the chemical companies is overwhelming, and farmers are exposed to that every day. No one's advertising, hey, you can do much better if you don't buy anything.
Do you think we can feed the same number of people that we have with organic practices?
I would compare our yields on this farm with any chemical farm in the world, and I bet we'd beat them.
Yeah.
And we're on poor soil on the coast of Maine and with a short season. There is absolutely nothing that can't be done in agriculture without chemicals. I mean, people fed themselves. Yields were fantastic on good farms for the last 10,000 years of agriculture. The chemicals have only been around since the 1840s. And only been around since there was a huge opportunity to sell farmers replacements for stuff that they otherwise got free.
Is that one of the reasons, Elliot, you're going back into livestock next year to increase the amount of nitrogen you can produce locally?
Well, in order to make our farm even more viably sustainable, any organic farm that has to bring organic matter in from another farm is sort of running a not quite totally sustainable system, and we've long wanted to make ours as cyclical as possible here on this little piece of land, and yes, that's why we're getting back into livestock, beside the fact that I like to eat the products.
I want to remind listeners that this is Pledge Week at WERU, and you can call us anytime at 1-800-643-6273. We appreciate a pledge of any amount. There's no minimum. There are premiums for large pledges, but you can call in with any amount, renew, add additional gifts. You can also call us at Common Health if you have questions or comments for Elliot Coleman or Bob St. Peter at 866-625-9378. Well, I have two. Oh, and we have a pledge, I see, from White's Orchard Farm in Frankfurt, and they're a business renewal. Thank you very much for your renewal.
And White's Orchard, Elliot mentioned ultra pasteurized milk. White's Orchard sells raw milk.
They're the best.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a plug. Thanks.
Where do you buy their milk?
At the co-op.
At the co-op. Well, there it is, Blue Hill Co-op. And I wanted to talk a little bit. I mean, this agribusiness issue is huge. I saw the impact as far away as Bangladesh and Ecuador and other countries I've worked on. But there's also the way agribusiness is marketing products. And I have two products in front of me I brought today as props. One is a cardboard tube of oats, and the other is a box of Life cereal. And the oats just say 100% rolled oats, but the Life cereal has a picture of Superman and says whole grain Quaker oats on it. And indeed, the cereal has 25% of everything you need. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to let that comment stand. I'd love to hear a response to that, but we have another caller on the line, so we're going to get that caller on first. Come in.
Hello.
Yes, you're on.
This is Jean from Belfast, and maybe due to the mix-ups and everything, I didn't quite get the answers to two questions. The one was for Elliot, and that was which crops benefit from seaweed right away and which ones like it better last year. And the other one, you know, since we are in Maine, I do live on the beach, and I don't want to read two whole books. I just want the answer. And the other one was the general question of what can be done locally right now to make the organic produce cheaper for regular people. That's all.
Well, as far as the seaweed question goes, the three crops that I think benefit from seaweed right on top of the soil until then before they're planted would be potatoes, tomatoes, and beets. And pretty much everybody else is in the year after category. And I think we discussed the cheaper organic food question enough. But basically, I don't think it's the role of the farmer to solve that problem.
Bob has an answer too.
I have some, you know, some thoughts and some bad news. And the bad news is that food off of the farm, local organic food off the farm, isn't going to get any cheaper because farmers, as Elliot said, I think farmers have a right to earn a decent livelihood, and we expect certain people in our society who contribute great deals, you know, farmers, teachers, to be martyrs in a sense, and to accept low pay for the amount of for the value that they contribute. In terms of making it more affordable, there's a good deal of money on the Blue Hill Peninsula, and I mentioned earlier about federal subsidies, but what if we started subsidizing our local food system? Those who have money pay more for food. If we have a CSA, if a farm has a CSA, and you've got a couple grand kicking around, you know, why not buy a few shares for people? You know, start subsidizing our local food system with the resources that we have available to us. That is how we're going to increase access to local high quality food, because there is labor that goes into producing food on a small scale, and labor. If we want people in our community to farm for a living and to live here and have us reap the benefits of having an agricultural landscape and an agricultural economy, then we're going to have to pay those people to do the work. So if I can make a plug for CSAs, it would be to for people who have the money and the resources to buy additional shares or purchase land and give it to somebody who's going to farm and help them to get their food to market. You know, that's how the big barriers are land and labor. There isn't a lot that a poor, struggling farmer can do about that, or somebody who has no money or resources who wants to get in farming can do about that. So is
I have a couple of suggestions for institutions that are already out there. I shop at the Belfast Co-op because I live about 3 miles from there, and I hardly ever get to the Blue Hill Co-op. But I noticed that the Belfast Co-op has wonderful produce section, but almost everything in it is imported from California or somewhere else. And if something could be done to get local food there and earmarked with big signs, local, 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 that would help a lot, I think. And the other one would be if there were more access for regular folks to order bunches of food ahead. Like, for example, I would like to order winter squash and buy a bunch of it instead of, one or two at a time at the store.
Well, thank you for your call, Jean. We're going to see if there are any other responses from Bob or Elliot on that. And do we have another call? Oh, I guess we have another call, so we'll go right to that. Come in.
Hello, this is Sarah, and I actually had the great pleasure of working with Bob at Sustainable Harvest International before he started working at the Good Life Center. So, hello.
Hi, Sarah.
How are you?
Nice to hear from you. Good.
I work for Sustainable Harvest International here in Surrey, but I spent a good part of the year now in North Carolina, and I joined the show a little late, so I apologize. It sounds like this may have already been talked about, but one of the great things that I found there is my husband and I joined the CSA program there, and I was just wondering what CSA resources there were for people in this area, and you may have already addressed this with that last call, but it's a wonderful program for us. It's very affordable. It's about $14 a week for our share, and we get a box of vegetables, and we're, you know, we're connected with what we're getting every week. We know what's available. We know that if the farmer that we're getting our vegetables from is having a problem with, you know, their tomato, that we might not get that many tomatoes that week. But it's a really great way for us to be connected with the food that we're getting. It's fairly affordable for us, and it's a great way to support a local farm. So I just didn't know if there are CSA programs here available in this part of Maine or not.
Well, thank you for the call, Sarah. You know, I before they answer that, could you just tell the listeners very quickly about Sustainable Harvest and what you're doing overseas for this?
Sure. Sustainable Harvest International is a nonprofit organization. We're working out of our, we call them our world headquarters here in Surrey, Maine, but it is a very small staff here. And what we do is we hire local farmers from communities requesting assistance in alternatives to slash and burn farming practices. And we're working in Honduras, Belize, Nicaragua, and Panama currently. And our staff there essentially work as local extension agents, teaching all sorts of different types of alternatives to slash and burn farming. And also we do some work with alternative energy production and things like that. So real simple techniques farmers can use to improve their soil quality there.
And you have a website?
We sure do. It's www.sustainableharvest.org.
Great. Thank you so much for your call.
And Sustainable Harvest is also doing a fantastic job of improving the nutrition of families that they work with, and particularly children who, you know, don't have access to a high-quality, varied diet. So by having viable small-scale farms, just as we would benefit here, you know, they're benefiting nutritionally from having access to those foods.
So,
hey guys, let me just jump in here for
sure.
A sec to say thank you for the opportunity to be on this show, but I got to get back to harvesting. So,
thank you for joining us, Elliot.
I'll let Bob finish up for me, but it's been a pleasure. Thanks again.
Yeah, you've been great. Thanks, Elliot.
Bye.
I was just handed a piece of paper that says that Fisher Farm in Winterport has a CSA. I know that King Hill Farm in Penobscot has a CSA. And as far as other CSAs that people are looking for this resource, MOFCA.org is a wonderful resource for access to wonderful resource for local farms generally, but also CSAs.
And what does CSA stand for again?
Community Supported Agriculture. And the way it works, it goes to what I was talking about earlier about subsidizing our local food system. It's not necessarily a subsidy, but the way it works is in the early spring, when a farmer or a farm typically needs an inflow of cash, people buy shares in the farm, and they will receive a share each week of whatever's harvested. So they're actually investing in the farm and in the farmer. You know, so it's a way of connecting, of taking ownership of our local food system, and not having the farmer bear all the responsibility. If their crops fail, then oh well, it's too bad, they don't have any food to sell at market. But we're actually taking some of the responsibility for the food that we access.
Boy, we've had a flurry of calls, but we want more. You can call a pledge to WERU to help us attain our goal of $60,000 this week, and you can do that by calling 1-800-643-6273. You can also pledge online at www.weru.org. If you'd like to join us on Common Health with your comments and questions, you can call 866-625-9378, and we have a caller on the line. Please come in. You're
Hello.
On.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm Olenka, and I live in Brooklyn, and I just wanted to say first that we have a CSA in Brooklyn, too. It's Stoneset Farm, and getting to the back to the price of organic food, I'm a home gardener, home organic market gardener, and I haven't bought any produce at the co-op since the middle of June, and I probably won't till October or November because of my own garden. And because of that, saves me a lot of money. And then during the winter, I feel I can buy any organic food I want. I don't care how much it costs because I've saved money through my own home garden. And I shop almost exclusively at the co-op in Blue Hill, and it's wonderful, and I attribute my good health partly to that. And then the third thing I wanted to mention, which I'd like Bob to comment on if he would, is I grew up in Nebraska, and I go back there occasionally, and, of course, there are miles and miles and miles of corn, and people think it looks so beautiful. And I look at it, and I just see it as such a sick form of agriculture. And then when I think of using soil fertility to put fuel in our automobiles, to me, that's immoral. And I just heard over the radio that Maine is going to start carrying ethanol, gasoline. And Bob, I wondered if you could comment about using soil fertility to fuel automobiles.
We'll take a quick comment, and then we've got another caller. So thank you for your call.
I agree with Olenka in that soil fertility ought first be used to feed people and to nourish people. And then if there is excess, and it doesn't look like there's going to be excess for biofuels and to continue our way of life and using our automobiles the way we do. If for some reason there happens to be, then that's a possible use. But first and foremost, soil fertility ought to be for feeding people.
We have another caller on the line. Can you hear me?
Hello, yes.
Come in.
I'm Charlotte Young. I am owner and farm manager of Shalom Orchard Organic Farm and Winery in Franklin, Maine. And we do have a CSA that I wanted to let people know about. We feature fruits. We have apples, blueberries, cherries, raspberries, peaches, and we sell a full range of vegetables plus chicken and eggs and lamb. My number is 207-565-2312. I'd love to talk to anyone about membership in the CSA for next year. Thank you.
Thank you for your call. Well, so the CSAs are coming out of the woodwork. I have to say that another issue that, and I tried to get to it earlier, and the call volume's been so great, but that there are a lot of empty calories out there, and it looks cheap, 25 cents, and you get your ho-ho or dum-dum or some other appropriately named snack food or a box of a ready-made cereal, and it's loaded with calories and carbohydrates and sprayed with a mix of vitamins, so it would appear to be a cheap, nutritious food, but is it really cheap? And if these foods are a great savings, how do we pay the price later with rising levels of obesity and multiple chronic diseases that we're having in this country? There's got to be a connection there.
It comes down to access. I am low income. If I had to go out in the marketplace and buy my food with my income, I would have to look at where can I get the greatest number of calories to feed myself and my family with the money that I have? And if you're buying organic fruits and vegetables, which, are full of vitamins and minerals and nutrients, you're not going to get a lot of calories. But if you're buying, processed junk food, that's been fortified and has calories and salt and sugar and whatnot, then you're going to get more calories. And so it's not coincidental that there is a link between low income and illnesses or like obesity and other diet related diseases.
And corn syrup seems to be a particular culprit. I know we're picking on corn today, and that's probably because it doesn't grow very well in Maine. Yeah. But what's this connection, Bob? I know you've done some research on this.
Well, in the early 70s, U.S. agriculture policy shifted from direct payments for farmers based on how much they produce. And so farmers were basically encouraged to produce as much as they could. And the USDA subsidizes certain crops, and corn is one of those. And So starting in the early 70s, we had this enormous glut of corn in the marketplace. And food processors saw this as an opportunity to make a whole lot of money, because now they had this cheap input that they could then put in all numbers of things. And so in the 70s, a company developed high fructose corn syrup, which now is in everything. It's in ketchup, it's in soups, it's in cakes, it's in soft drinks, it's in everything. Is it in that box of cereal? It's in the box of Life cereal. So you now have this new sweetener in the marketplace that is incredibly cheap, cheaper than sugar, if you can imagine that. And in the early 1980s, Coca-Cola and PepsiCo shifted from using sugar to using high fructose corn syrup. And so in the last 25 years, high fructose corn syrup has become the number one sweetener. And there is, if I have the numbers of money here, I don't have the dollar figures, but high fructose corn syrup is the most valuable corn derivative. And so the more food processors can get this into our food, the better off they are. And this is an important point, that food marketers and food processors have a profit motive for getting us to eat more food. And so in the last 25 years or so, 30 years, there has been actually more calories available for people to consume. And it's in these really sneaky places like soda and cereal and all these other things.
And the insidious element, and I know we have another call and I want to pick that up, but we may not have the right signaling system in our bodies to deal with it. With sugar, we kind of say, oh, that's enough, and we stop. We probably should stop sooner. But with corn syrup, that signal doesn't come until pretty late. And so we've taken on a lot more carbohydrate, this sort of simple processed carbohydrate, than we can tolerate, and that can contribute to diabetes and other kinds of diseases. Mm-hmm. I better take this call. The phone line's still blinking, so come in.
Hi, this is Jenny in Sedgwick.
Hi, Jenny.
And unfortunately have two passions in my life, that's teaching and farming, so I'm poor. But a couple comments I had to make were, one is people saying how organic food is expensive and things like that, and I just wonder if you went to another country, even third world countries, what is the ratio of what you're spending your paycheck on? I, for some reason, think the majority is probably food. And so if you want to have VCRs and video games and ATVs and whatever toys and things you want, then you might be putting your importance on that rather than the nutrition for yourself and your family. And is that really a good idea? And my other thought is that we are, as far as I know, as a society, working a lot more hours than we ever had before. And as a mother of three children who works, I find dinner time's really hard, and I want to not have to think so much about what I have to cook or not cook and put together. And I know all of these TV dinners and things that are instant foods, and your kids can even make it in the microwave, and that makes you think life is easier because it doesn't take so long to prepare food. And then, but what you're ending up with is ill health. And I've been experimenting lately with mostly raw diet. And I'm so grateful that we have raw milk in our community. And one thing that I've found in the research is that the more raw foods you eat, the more digestive enzymes you're putting into your system, and you actually begin to crave less food because your body's utilizing the food it's being given rather than getting this nutrition that isn't really accessible to your body. And so you eat it and you get full, and then it goes and passes through and you're hungry again, because you didn't actually get enough nutrition for your body to be healthy.
That's a great, great point. I thank you for your call. We're going to try to squeeze one more call in before our time's up, and our time is running out quickly. So do you have a quick comment or question?
Yes, I just got on, started listening, but has anybody mentioned Omnivore's Dilemma?
Yes.
They have. You're on the show already?
Mentioned it. I take it you like the book also.
Yes, very much. It's a must summer read. Lots of info on what you guys are talking about.
Thank you for calling.
Bye.
Well, we do need to wrap up soon, but first, let me say that this is WERU's Pledge Week, and we encourage you to call. We need your support to bring programs like Common Health and Barefoot Blues Hour and Morning Maine and you name it, Democracy Now! So you can help by calling 1-800-643-6273 and make your pledge, or you can pledge online at www.weru.org. Bob, any responses? We've had a lot of calls, not much chance to respond to them all. You've got another minute or so.
Well, in response to what Jenny had asked about food and percentage of dollars spent on food, I can only assume that people in less developed, poorer countries spend a greater portion of their money on food. In this country, interestingly enough, a couple generations ago, people spent about a third of their income on food. Now today, if that's less than, that's 10 to 15% on average people spend. And if you make a greater income, then that percentage goes even further down. But it comes down to a matter of priorities, both for our personal health and for our community health. And where do we want to put our dollars? Do we want to put them into electronics? Do we want to put them into consumer goods, or do we want to put them into healthy, nutritious food? And I would also just add that The Omnivore's Dilemma is a fantastic read, and Michael Pollan gets into the issue of our culture and how what he calls our national eating disorder as a result of all of this centralization of our food and this processing of our food, and that we've lost this connection, and that culturally we're not really tied to our food, so we're willing to just take whatever comes down the pike.
So, quick hit way to improve your health and take some pounds off. Get out there and garden. Grow your own food. Join a CSA where you pay a farmer a monthly fee and you get fresh organic food in a box each month or each week.
Each week. You pay in the spring, and then you get the share throughout the summer weekly.
Spend more on raw foods. Eat more raw foods. Less prepackaged junk food. And we're out of time. Enough advice from me. So we've come to the end of our program for this month. Be sure to visit our website, commonhealth.org, where you'll find helpful background on a variety of public health topics, including audio archives, and a place for you to contribute questions for our future shows. Common Health theme music is Picaba, performed by Eric Horshack. Thanks to our guests, Bob St. Peter and Elliot Coleman. Thanks to Amy Brown for engineering and our underwriters and members for supporting all of our public affairs and news programs. Common Health airs on the third Wednesday of the month from 10 to 11 with support from Hancock County Planning Commission, the University of Maine Cooperative Extension, and Hancock County Coalition for Community Health. Join us on September 20th for a dialogue about schools and health. We've come to expect a lot from our schools, providing health and physical education, feeding, dispensing medications, controlling substance abuse, preventing violence. What goes on behind the scenes to make this happen? Thanks for listening and for your suggestions for future programs. Email us at commonhealth@weru.org and stay tuned for On the Wing with your host, Brother Bob. This is you, good health.